Hello and welcome to Theatre Voice, the Victoria and Albert Museum's performance podcast. Zoe Wanamaker is something of a one-off. She has an impish quality on stage and an ardency as well. It's a combination that's allowed her to mix light comedy with high tragedy, as proven by her two Olivier Awards, one for Hart and Kaufman's vaudeville Once in a Lifetime, the other for Electra. She's racked up some great roles in her time, Sally Bowles, Eliza Doolittle, Amanda Wingfield, but hit a purple patch in recent years, one that began with a twinkling Beatrice at the National Theatre, each insult steeped in irony. Then came a devastating Kate Keller in Howard Davis's Return to All My Sons, a total amnesiac in Nick Payne's Elegy, and last year, Pinter's blustering B&B owner Meg in The Birthday Party. She is almost innately watchable. A creature of the theatre, or rather, a child of it. Wanamaker's father, Sam, was an American director who set up Shakespeare's Globe. So Heather Neal began by asking Zoe Wanamaker all about him.
I was born in New York, and because Dad knew he was going to be subpoenaed before the un-American activities. We used to have a nanny because I had an elder sister. My mother worked in radio as an actress at that time. She was a famous radio star. Yeah.
Charlotte Holland.
Yes. Aggie, her name was, used to take me to Catholic Church, which apparently I found the most exciting thing in the world.
Dressing up,
incense, lots of chanting, costumes, I think. So my mother maintains that that's when it started. I was lucky because my parents, being who they were, loving England, coming to England as refugees in a way, because their passports were taken away, had a sort of thirst for culture. So we were taken to museums, we were taken to art galleries, we were taken to concerts, we were taken to the theatre a lot. And I remember being disappointed when there was an interval. But I think the idyllic, I suppose, that time was when Dad was at Stratford, and before Peter Hall made it the Royal Shakespeare Company. And Daddy used to row to work on the Avon. And because he was fanatically always been keeping fit, and so that's what he did, that was his regime. And I remember going into the theatre and smelling the size of for the flats, the seal that they paint the flats with, the Leichner number 9s and all that, and it was so romantic, the swans going up and down, and the year of the Sputnik, that was, and all of that, countryside and beauty, romantic. I think that's probably when it really hit, and meeting people like Ian Holm and Roy de Treese and Albert Finney and Vanessa Redgrave, and I mean just all these giants, beautiful people, beautiful. It was so glamorous. And I think, you know, it was a fantasy world.
But they weren't too keen for you to go into it to begin with, were they, your parents?
Not at all.
So.
not at all. Because, firstly, I was a woman, and secondly, I wasn't pretty. And thirdly, rejection is the main name of the game. They just wanted me to try something else, and understandably, because, you know, it's a very painful business to be rejected, and it's very difficult for the ego and for the and for the heart and the soul, because it's arbitrary. Art is arbitrary. It's about taste. It's about somebody else's opinion, somebody else's vision of things, and. You know, I might like Picasso, somebody else might not. You know, it's the same difference. And to be judged all the time is something that I don't like.
But you did go to Central, and
I did, yes.
And you started in reps, and you seem to have worked all over the place. You did your 40 weeks.
I did.
You've
my
just
40.
Shown me your worksheet. That's fascinating.
Yes, because in those days, when I left drama school, which was 1970, you had to get, for your full equity card, and you had to be an equity member, you had to do 40 weeks in repertory, doing whatever, but working in the theatre ostensibly. I mean, television was just beginning to break in, but you had to do that. And then you sent in your chart where you just how many weeks you'd done, how much you got paid, when you started. But yes, my first job out of drama school was doing Midsummer Night's Dream, what was then in Manchester. I remember my first week at rehearsal, I had an argument with the director, which was typical, and I just had an argument, because I was playing Hermia and Delia Lindsay was playing Helena, and he thought Helena was the bee's knees and that Hermia was a cow. So I had this fight with him. Defending Hermia.
Well, in 1979 for the RSC, you were in Once in a Lifetime and you won an Olivier.
Mm-hmm.
You're playing Mae Daniels.
Yes.
Now, you've won two Oliviers, and the other one's for Electra. Mm-hmm. There could scarcely be a greater contrast.
Mm-hmm.
I wondered about that. Do you feel more at home in comedy or in tragedy, or do you just treat each character as a character?
Each character is exactly the same. It's a question of timbre, I suppose. Yes, each character you have to work. My dad said to me once, he said, you've been at drama school, you went to drama school for 3 years and you're asking me how do you find a character? and the questions that my dad said, why did the writer write the play? What does the director want to do with the play? What does your character, if you took your character out of the play, what would happen to the play? And that's how it goes on. And then why is your character important to the play? And those sort of things are a staple to me.
Yes. And you think through those questions every time
yes.
you take on a part.
Mm. But that's the beginning.
Yes.
And then you go deeper. But each character has its own life and its own
yes.
personality and its own foibles. And so it depends on the writing. It's always the writing.
Yeah.
The writing is all.
Well, I suppose many people will know you for television and film, for My Family mm-hmm. on television particularly, and Madame Hooch in Harry Potter, mm-hmm. And now Killing Eve and lots of other things. But I think you have said that you really particularly enjoy theatre, and what you've just been saying suggests that you enjoy the process, the longer time you spend making your character.
It is an organic thing, and I find that with film and television you're very much on your own. You have to create these things by yourself and you have to work it out by yourself. You don't get any time. I find also the hours are not conducive to me. I'm not an early person. I don't enjoy having makeup put on me at 5 o'clock in the morning, and it doesn't work. I think because I was brought up with the theatre, that that's a space which I feel that I can grow and develop, and it gets better and better the more I do it.
Yes. Yes, I think you've said that, actually. Acting is a craft and not a calling, and you just get better the more you do it.
Well, you hope to. I mean, you hope to. You hope to learn. I mean, you start. Most actors feel that once they get to a new piece of work, it is as if they've never done it before, and that they're still just as insecure and just as... it's never the same. You can never repeat that, or you try not to repeat that. And also, it's scary. It gets more and more frightening.
you used the word hovercrafting to describe... I think it was when you were in Stevie at Chichester in 2014, another amazing character playing a real person this time, which is quite unusual for you, isn't it, to play somebody who's actually
lived. It's such a good play by Hugh Whitemore.
Oh, yeah.
It's just a brilliant piece of work. It's sort of, well, it's also to do with every play like Viola or any character. If when you feel that you are it and it is you, and that you have no sense of working at it. Mm-hmm. The great thing also about the theatre is that you can hear an audience, you can feel an audience, and so you have to share it with an audience. And if you can not be aware of every line or word, it just flows out of you, and that's what I call hovercrafting. It becomes a sort of spiritual thing that you literally feel as if you're it. Mm. My mother once gave me a book called Zen and the Art of Archery, which is a small book, and it's about a man who wanted to learn about Zen. And he started to... he went to an archery class. He was in Japan. And this tiny book is about it, and it's about the master kept saying, "You're working at it. You're working at it."
What you can see in the wheels turning.
He said, you're trying too hard, and you are the target. The target is you. That's all you have to do. And that's the same difference in my mother.
But are there times when that
doesn't happen?
Because it sounds...
No, it doesn't happen, and it's all about...
Extraordinary, really.
It is.
You can't know when you begin, can you?
When you feel relaxed, when something, it just flows out of you, when it's, you're not thinking about it too much.
Mm. Now, obviously, you enjoy working with some directors, particularly. I mean, Howard Davis, who unfortunately no longer with us, but you clearly enjoyed working with him and did many times, didn't you?
Mm, about 9.
Yes.
I was lucky. I first worked with him on PF.
Yes, that was 78.
And that was
with Jane Lapaterre as Edith, yeah.
And Ian Charlson.
Oh, yes.
And many others. I was the first director. I didn't care what I did with my hands. And through rep, I was very conscious about what I was doing with my hands, or where to put them, my pockets, around my fold them. And it was the first director who actually gave me a focus. And I liked him. He was also funny, and he also found me funny, even when I wasn't trying to be funny. So he also knew when I was it wasn't right, and he knew how to correct me. It was a teacher in a way, but a guide. He was a director and a great help. Because sometimes an actor gets lost and can't find a through line to it, and the director is there to help. See what it looks like from out front, what it looks like, what it feels like, what it sounds like. And if you're not getting any feedback, encouragement or discouragement or whatever, discussion, then you feel that you're floundering. Mm. And sometimes that happens. That happens a lot, particularly in television and film.
And I presume he's a director. He was a director who enjoyed your contribution, your ideas.
Mm. Yes.
And isn't it true to say most directors do now? I mean, is that?
Oh yes, there's always a discussion. I mean, that's what's.
You don't just get told to move from here to there. And
no, absolutely not. Sometimes they don't tell you where to go at all.
No.
Howard. Yeah, he was lovely. I just really enjoyed him. As a human being as well as a director. It's a rare thing to find. And I think a lot of directors don't really understand what actors do or how they get that. Well, because everybody's different. Everybody gets there at a different rate, a different time. Some people are very good at auditions and no good at any other time. And now it's a completely different era now that we're moving into, that everything is self-taping, as they call it, and so you do it on your phone or you do it. Mm. And I suppose in the same difference, it happened with, there was a photographic album called Spotlight, which had everybody's photograph in it. I remember when I was, before I went to drama school, I was given a script by a wonderful casting director called Miriam Brickman, who's now dead, who cast Oh, What a Lovely War, Albert Finney's first films, and The Sporting Life, and those kind of films. And she threw me a script of Isadora, with Vanessa Redgrave playing Isadora, and she said, I've got to go to the set of Oh, What a Lovely War in Brighton, I'll be back. Here's Spotlight, here's the script. When I come back, tell me, cast her best friend and see who. So when she came back, she opened the Spotlight from A to Z, I did, of people I thought, women, I thought would look like or looked as if they could be Vanessa's best friend. Well, she opened the book and she went, oh, Zoe, no. And then, oh, that photograph's very old. And that's how it went. Quick. I was appalled. But it's the same thing happening now on tape. Yes. Or what they call self-taping. It's the same thing. Sometimes you don't even get a...
Yeah.
You don't even get to see it.
It's hard.
It's hard. It's rejection.
Yeah. Well, we have to mention, amongst the other productions he did with you... All My Sons, which was in 2010, I think, which was fantastic, wasn't it?
Yes.
What was that like to be in? Was that gruelling to be in? Was it very emotional?
Yes, it was. It is very much. But I think that play is so... It's such a strong... comment on human nature, and Miller writes this extraordinary relationship with his characters, of the wife, and all of his work, most of his work is character based, and it's about not aesthetics, it's about human frailties. That's why Shakespeare is so extraordinary. And I think it was also because I worked with David before, and...
David Suchet?
Yes. And he was the one who taught me what an iambic pentameter was. Because when I went to Stratford, I didn't quite know. So we had a very good relationship with, and an honest one. So yes, that was a great time.
Yes. Well, did your family knew Miller, didn't they?
Yes.
Your father certainly did.
Definitely.
Because he too was...
blacklisted. Well, he married Marilyn Monroe, so he got away with it.
Yeah. Yes, because they wanted to meet Marilyn, didn't they?
Yes. But when Dad was young, when he went to New York, he started a company that went, a theatre company, and he did the plays, little plays, and Arthur Miller wrote a play for him. That was years and years and years ago, when he would take to factories and shipyards and things like that. Mm. So just Dad, yeah, knew him.
And when you did The Crucible in 1990, wasn't it? Didn't your father then talk to you, because of the theme of The Crucible, about what had happened in more detail than he had before? Was that the opportunity?
Absolutely. Mm. That was the first time he'd ever spoken about it. And... I saw his when they came to this country. He took a job in England, knowing that he was going to be subpoenaed, and then didn't go back. And sure enough, he was subpoenaed. And Mum had put everything in storage, and we came over. I think my elder sister and I came over.
You were about three at the time.
That's right. Yeah. And but he was followed all the time, apparently, by MI5. Anyway, yes, it was the first time that he had talked to me about. That he had joined the Communist Party for a year or two and then felt he was being used. So we went into a lot of detail about that. So I'd never known that. Mm-hmm. It had been very... I remember him getting his files, even way before that, when I was about 15. He received his files, which were blanked out, a lot of them, but then the... And that's the only time I remember him talking about it at all.
Mm. Yes. Did he not? I'm going now by Diana Devlin's new biography of your father. Mm. Did he not say to you that he was anxious that he perhaps should have stayed and fought rather than come here? To you, because he was obviously had a special link with you, but probably because of the Crucible and because you were acting.
Mm. I think, well, we did have a good relationship, I think. Mm. I was lucky enough to, when I turned in my 20s, I was lucky enough to see my parents as people, with their own relationship and their own. So I was, that's a good thing to happen to a person. I think it's very healthy. Yes, he felt some sort of, I think he felt, I don't want to put words into because the recollection of exactly what he said is not clear, but I know that he felt that he had somehow felt slight, not guilt about it or regret about it, but he had two children, and he also didn't want to acknowledge that the Un-American Activities Committee should exist at all, because it was illegal. So in a way, I think he gained from coming to this country.
Yes.
I think he gained.
And so did we.
And so did we. Yes. Yes.
Well, we mentioned Miller, but you have said that you always choose what you do next by the writing, how good the writing is. Mm. What is it you're looking for? Is it speakability, or is it characterization, or is it is there something which just clicks and you think, this is a good one? I mean.
Mm.
Hugh Whitemore, particularly, you just mentioned, who wrote Stevie, and of course, you know, we've got classics doing. You've done Chekhov and Shakespeare. Mm, so.
It's to do with just the language, or the. It's really the character's journey and what happens to them, I think, and I can't really be specific. If it's clunky writing, I find that usually you find some television, you'll find clunky writing, obvious writing.
Mm.
And you have to somehow manoeuvre your way through that. I'm not a writer. I can't rewrite. I mean, in my family, sometimes they would say to me, well, what would you like to say? Well, Robert, of course, Lindsay, would come out with all sorts of crap.
in my family, yes.
That's why I didn't do it anymore, because the writing has become, it became a football team. And if they end up by saying to the actor, well, what would you like to write? Would you like to write it? Then that's the end.
Yes.
I mean, it started with an American writer, Fred Barron. That was how it was created. That's why I did it, because it was witty. It wasn't English in the sense that it wasn't Benny Hill. It had wit. It had understanding of character, of behaviour between people, between the couple. The best scenes were the bed scenes, the bedroom scenes, because Robert and I got on, he made me laugh a lot, and we make each other laugh. But as it went on longer and longer, Fred left, then other people, and then it became English. So they would set up a gag and then have a gag, and then set up a gag and have a gag, and then it became boring.
Mm-hmm.
Because that's not what it should have been about. Mm-hmm. It's about an insight into family dynamics.
Mm-hmm. But it must be harder in a way when you're doing theatre, because it's so kind of exposing, isn't it? And you have to keep doing it.
Yes, but if I keep doing it, you get it right. I get it right. Yeah. I mean, there is a time when I have a little person on the back of a voice saying, you know, that was terrible, that was bad, that was awful, that was bad. Then you can do it again the next time and get it right. Or get it right for yourself, how it sounds. In film and television, you have a couple of chances, or there's a lot of... Everything's for the shots. The technicians, and then they bring on the actors.
Well, you've just done Two Ladies at the Bridge by Nancy Harris, a woman writer, and you have in the past, bewailed the lack of women writers and directors and opportunities for women. Do you think that's improving?
I hope it's improving. I think it is. But unless they're any good, why do it? Unless it's good writing, unless it's good directing, unless it's good, you know. This is across the board to anything, to anybody, any colour, shape, size. It's the encouragement to write, which is for women to find, and for us to find that voice. It's all about education. And also, for a director, it's the interest in actually putting on a piece of work.
Yes.
And well, that's what has to be.
The director in that case, of course, was Nicholas Heitner, and you worked with him before. And to come now to one of my favourite productions of all time, which was the Much Ado that you did with Simon Russell Beale at the National Theatre. That looked like such fun to be in. It was certainly fun to watch. Was it as much fun as it looked?
It was, because of Nick's idea of the casting. Having Simon and I being older people.
Yes.
And I think
middle-aged people. Might be losing their last chance to.
Yes, and also, but about because they're smart and because they are cynical and because they don't have ideals. And that's why it's a wonderful play, because there's Hero and Claudia who are, it's about lust. And so it's the balance of the two loves. So the more mature love is the one that is about knowing that people aren't perfect.
Yes.
And enjoying that.
Yes. And also being willing to do amazing things like jumping into water up to your neck.
Yes, it's an old gag.
But it worked.
Yeah, of course.
I thought, not going to do it again. And it worked again. I just thought,
oh, good.
It won't work again. But it did. Oh. It was so funny.
Oh, I'm glad. Yes.
Well, that was 2007, I think. But you've done a lot at the National and you're an associate there, aren't you? So is it kind of a favourite place?
Well, the principal is favourite. I mean, like the Royal Shakespeare Company, that principal is favourite. I'm lucky to have been an associate. I don't know why. I think Nick, when he started, developed a whole associate idea, so that there would be which is a good one. I mean, Nick came, Richard Eyre, and well, actually, when I first joined the National, first worked at the National, as opposed to the RSC, it's like Concord. It was like Concord, in the sense that it was organised and it was seemed smooth running. That's when Peter was there, compared to the RSC, which is sort of a bit more fustier. Not fusty, it was more, it wasn't so tidy. It's a generalised picture. And there was a feeling walking into that building of a great energy, of stuff happening, lots of stuff happening. Of course, because there are three theatres in
yes.
there. And there's also outside stuff that they developed. And so I just also think that there should be a National Theatre. There also should be a Royal Shakespeare Company Theatre. But that means the Royal Shakespeare Company, thank goodness, has that the other place, and so it has a new place where you can discover new work, which is why I actually joined in 1978 with Howard. I only did The Taming of the Shrew. That was the only Shakespeare I did that year, because I wanted to work with new work. Yes, but I do think that companies are very important, but that's a different generation now as well. People working together because the RSC was you spent a year at Stratford and then you took it to Newcastle, then you came into London. That was the idea.
Yes. Well, we have to mention the Globe, which is, I know you're very much associated with it, but and have been on the stage, but not in a play. I mean,
no. Mark Rylance asked me if I would be the opening speech of Henry V, the chorus. And so officially, I was officially for the Queen. This was for the Queen,
yeah.
Which I thought I was going to have a heart attack. But because when Dad was dying, you know, we had a conversation, and which was
a few years before the opening, of course.
Oh God, yes.
He didn't see.
No, he never saw it. 93, he died. Yeah. December 93. But we were talking about it, and he said, "You don't want to direct. You don't want to produce. You don't want to, you know, you don't want to run a theatre." I said, "No, I don't." And he said, "Well, that's good, because I don't think you should." Because I get too emotional. So I'm in really an honorary whatever to the Globe, because it was his child, his passion, his, the tenacity of the man.
Amazing. Yes.
Extraordinary. 27 years of his life, which he, from all the doors being shut in his face all the time, that energy, belief, was phenomenal. So I know it cost him so much, and my mother too.
Yes, they gave up their house at one stage, didn't they?
They did. They gave up their house and they moved to Southwark, a place called the Surrey Dispensary, which was on the corner of Falmouth Road and Trinity Street. Nobody went. And when I was working at the RSC one night, I was late home, and I was living in that house in the basement, which used to be an electrical store. It had lots of bulbs in there. And the taxi driver wouldn't take me. Wouldn't take me. So I'm not going there. So Borough, beyond, nobody would take me. And now, of course, it's... But Dad always said, you know, you wait, this whole area is going to explode.
Yeah.
He knew it. And he wanted for the Globe... I mean, he wanted a sort of university campus.
Yeah.
He wanted apartments for visiting artists. He wanted a film, a cinema to do films so you can see Shakespeare's films and things like that. He wanted an exhibition. He wanted a restaurant, a bar, and all that kind of stuff. And because he wanted it like the Seine, so that you walk along the Seine, the same thing. But, and now look at it.
But you wouldn't act there?
No.
No.
It's too much of a pressure, not only for me, but I think I'd just be too embarrassed. I don't know. It'd have to be a director to do it, because it is a fantastic space, though.
Yes, it is.
And it's frustrating when I do go and see things that the space isn't used. Sometimes when the stage isn't used well enough, it makes me want to... So that's why I'm not involved too much, because I chat too much and I would be just emotional, and that's not good.
Okay.
Board meetings, I can't do it.
Well, let's jump to something that you did last year, because, I mean, obviously it was an amazing production to be in, The Birthday Party.
Oh, yes.
Last year, with Ian Rickson as director. I think you got on very well with him as
yes,
well.
Yes, I did. I found another one. and I've admired his productions a lot in the past, and so this was a joy to do. I knew Stephen Mangan from... We did Cappuccino ages ago. And Toby Jones, I've admired a lot, and all that. So it was, and Peter White was just, it was perfect.
Well, we've talked a little bit about your response to writing. Well, you know, Pinter, another amazing writer.
Mm.
But you also do a lot of research, don't you? You do a lot of your own work.
Mm-hmm.
And clearly what you did for a Birthday Party ended up being quite a different relationship with Petey from what we've seen generally before, didn't you think?
Well,
you did a lot of work together on that, did you?
Or well, we all did. I mean, Ian's very... We went to Bournemouth for... What was it, Bournemouth? Eastbourne.
Mm.
We stayed a night in Eastbourne, and we did a lot of... Because that's where it was first done.
Yeah.
It was fascinating. But... Yes, that's what Ian likes to do, and I like to do. I was in The Birthday Party in 1970, blah blah, on a British Council tour where I played What's her name? The young one.
Yes, the neighbour. Yes.
Isn't that awful that we are? I didn't really...
She has. That isn't much of a part, though, is it, that one?
No, it's not, but it's quite... Now I see it's actually quite powerful. It's great.
Right.
It's a very... It's the one other woman.
Yes.
There aren't any
other
women.
Yes.
And they're quite pivotal, strong.
Yes.
But I don't know... I don't know that it was different from anybody else's. I mean, I saw Jones on... Joan Plowright's on... Mm. And that was a different sort of
thing. But you had a relationship with Peter Wright as Petey, didn't you?
Mm.
And obviously you had wanted a child or had had a child and lost it, or anyway, there was a gap there.
Mm. Yes.
And you must have talked about that a
yes,
lot.
Yes, we did.
Mm.
We did. But that's what we do. I mean, some actors don't do that, share it. Some actors do, and I shared it with Peter, and I shared it with Toby, and with Ian. I mean,
who was a substitute child?
Yeah.
Yes.
But sometimes it's best not to tell people.
Yeah.
Also, she was a terrible flirt.
Yes.
But I think that's what she. No, it's fascinating, and also I could hear Harold's voice. The first scene in that play is so funny; it's rhythmically. Hysterically funny.
Mm.
And it's a delight to speak, to play. And Harold was such a funny man. I met him a few times, and because he would be so grumpy, which was funny, it made me laugh. I couldn't help myself.
What, with the actors?
No, just generally, he'd just be very grumpy.
Mm.
But that was... He was hysterical. Yeah.
Well.
And he was warm, actually, and you know, actually, actors loved working with him.
Theatre Voice is an audio archive about British theatre. You can subscribe to the weekly podcast on iTunes or visit our website, theatrevoice.com, for hundreds of interviews with some of the world's leading theatre makers. This episode was hosted by Heather Neal and produced by Matt Truman and Helen Gush for the Victoria and Albert Museum in London. Thanks for listening.